Welcome to our growth summary of Pour Your Heart Into It by Howard Schultz, the former CEO of Starbucks. This is a memoir that details the story of how Starbucks grew from a small coffee shop chain in Seattle into a global brand. The book combines Schultz's personal journey with the principles and values that guided him in building Starbucks, emphasizing the importance of passion, perseverance, and authenticity in business. So, if you want to understand how to build a business driven by passion, purpose, and values, then Pour Your Heart Into It by Howard Schultz is a must-read. This book shares the inspiring journey of how Schultz transformed Starbucks into a worldwide brand, emphasizing the importance of staying true to your vision and creating a company culture that puts people first. Unlike other business books that focus on dry concepts, this one offers a personal and emotional view from a leader of a hugely successful company. And what's most impressive is that Schultz achieved his success in the coffee market, which many experts thought was already saturated and shrinking. Schultz shows that true leadership is about leading with heart and conviction to inspire confidence in others, even when you don't necessarily feel 100% confident yourself. So, whether you're just starting a business or you're a senior leader, this book will provide you with valuable insights into building a brand that deeply connects with people. In the following summary, we'll explore the key lessons from each chapter of Schultz's journey, so we can apply them to our own careers and businesses. So let's begin with the first big lesson, which is building confidence. This part of the book is about Schultz learning sales and perseverance by making 50 cold calls per day and being driven by his low-income upbringing to succeed. So we'll jump into the chapter one summary of this book. First point is about humble beginnings and his early drive. Howard Schultz grew up in a low-income neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York, called The Projects, where he worked early on as a teenager and even helped support his family. His father had a series of low-paying jobs that left him unfulfilled, such as factory work and truck driving. And this childhood situation strongly motivated Schultz to succeed, and seeing his father's struggles, eventually it made him want to create a company where every employee felt like they had a place and they felt valued. Next point is about building confidence through experience. So Schultz had a talent for football. He became the quarterback of his high school football team in a school that had over 5,000 people. And in this way, he earned a partial scholarship to Northern Michigan University, where he studied communications and business. To finish paying for his school, he took out loans and worked jobs like bartending. After graduating, he joined Xerox, where he learned sales by making 50 cold calls a day, going door to door. He says it was incredibly difficult work, but he learned more there about business than he did in all those years of college. Now, at the time, Xerox was famous for having the world's best sales training program. The next point is about his early career success. His next step was in joining Hammerplast, which was a Swedish houseware company. And there he managed 20 salespeople and began earning $75,000 a year, which at that time was a very significant salary. But despite that early success, Schultz kept looking for the next challenge, saying that enough was never enough. It was also during this period that he met his future wife, Sherry Kirsch, during a July 4th weekend in the Hamptons with his friends. So here's a connection to another book. Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki is one of the most popular books on business and investing. And surprisingly, Kiyosaki also went through that exact same sales training program by Xerox, and he even became one of their top five salespeople. Now, he quit a good career to learn sales at Xerox because he believed that sales and marketing are some of the most valuable skills anyone can learn. After all, we all need to sell something, whether it's our ideas or a product. So Robert Kiyosaki suggests that we choose jobs based on the skills we will gain from them, not just the salary. He worked on a Standard Oil ship to learn about trade. Then he joined the Marine Corps to develop leadership skills. And then he worked at Xerox to overcome his shyness and learn sales. And all of these skills later helped him when he started his first business importing wallets. As we'll see in a minute, Schultz's experience in cold calling at Xerox would also be key to his success. They would allow him later to raise the millions he needed from investors to grow Starbucks into his vision. But if you want to learn more from Robert Kiyosaki, check out our summary of his book, which is called Rich Dad Poor Dad on Growth Summary. That brings us to chapter 2. The first point is about discovering Starbucks. So it was 1981 and Schultz first learned about Starbucks, a small coffee company with just 4 stores in Seattle. So this little company was ordering an unusually large number of these basic coffee machines makers from Hammerplast. Being curious about how they were selling so many, he visited their store at Pike Place Market, meeting with a manager. And he was impressed by the special feeling of the store right away, with these old wooden counters and handmade fixtures. And he was amazed by the quality of their coffee. It was the best he'd ever had by far. He became so captivated by the company that he even called his wife that day, saying he wanted to move to Seattle. And then he met the founders. Schultz met the founders of Starbucks, which were Jerry Baldwin, Gordon Bowker, and Zeb Siegel. One thing that really struck him is they weren't typical business people. They were more into literature and history. That's what they'd study. That's what their early careers had been about. But they were introduced to high-quality coffee by a shop called Pete's Coffee in San Francisco, which was one of the first places to bring high-quality coffee to the U.S. Because at that time, people mostly ate much lower-quality canned coffee from the supermarket. So, the next point is about how Starbucks was always about building on a strong foundation. Those founders weren't just about making money, they believed in something. They thought everybody should be able to enjoy the highest quality coffee. The founders themselves would sometimes drive hours to get high-quality coffee beans. And so one day, with a few $1,000s, they decided to start Starbucks in Seattle. They focused on offering the best, freshest, dark-roasted coffee beans, and that became the heart of the company. And Howard Schultz saw that, and he believed that was a very strong foundation of values on which to build a much larger company. Now, I'm going to connect this to another book. Starbucks' origin story here is very similar to how Ray Kroc discovered McDonald's and turned it into a household brand name. You see, Ray Kroc was selling these milkshake mixers, and he noticed that one restaurant in California was ordering an unusually large number of them. Being curious, he went to go visit McDonald's, and he was so impressed by the whole operation and how popular the store was that he became fixated on the idea of franchising McDonald's nationwide. So in his biography, which is named Grinding It Out, Ray Kroc shares this business wisdom. He said, "You must perfect every fundamental of your business if you expect it to perform well." End quote. And then he explains how they meticulously optimized every part of McDonald's operations, even after he bought it. From the size and fat content of the hamburgers, to the type of wax paper used between the patties, so the person on the grill could quickly slap them on the grill to start cooking. And that whole mindset that you must perfect every little part of your business echoes a saying that Howard Schultz repeats quite a few times in this book, which is that everything matters. But if you want to learn more about that business success story, check out our summary of Grinding It Out by Ray Kroc, also on Growth Summary. Now here's a quiz question. How many cold calls did Schultz make each day while he was working at Xerox? Was it A, 25, B, 50, C, 75, or D, 100? The correct answer is 50 cold calls per day. So that brings us to big takeaway number two from this book, which is that perseverance over luck. Schultz succeeded by never giving up, securing funding for his new coffee business while enduring over 200 rejections from investors. Okay, let's get into it, beginning with chapter 3 summary. First point is about how he chased the Starbucks job. So, being captivated by that store and the company, Schultz spent a year trying to get a marketing leadership role at Starbucks, becoming their main marketing person. Even though people in his life, like his mother, thought it was way too risky to leave a good career, a high-paying career, for some small unknown company in Seattle on the other side of the country. But Howard Schultz worked very hard to connect with the founders. He found ways to visit Seattle a few times, and when they came to New York, they had dinner. And every time he tried to impress them with his ideas for the company, he would bounce product ideas they could sell off them. And then one day, they all met for a fancy dinner all together, and just when Howard Schultz thought he had the job offer handled coming to him, they called back and turned him down. And they said his vision, they believed, was too big and risky for Starbucks. But Schultz couldn't let it go, so he didn't give up. The next day he called back again with the founder he spoke to most, Jerry Baldwin, and he reopened the discussion. He asked what the concerns were and convinced Jerry Baldwin to take a chance on the more ambitious vision for Starbucks. And this determination paid off, as Schultz got the job offer that next day, and it was after most people would have quit. Okay, the next point is about inspiration from Italy. So it was a year later, after working at Starbucks, that Schultz visited Milan for a convention. And there he was amazed by the espresso bars that seemed to be on every corner. Now, these weren't just places to grab coffee. They felt like community hubs where people really connected, part of people's day. And Schultz realized that Starbucks could do that too. They could do more than just sell coffee beans by the pound. They could offer the whole coffee experience by the cup and bring that sense of community to the US, where he felt it had gone missing. Now, I want to connect this to another book, which is called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. That's a classic book on success and personal growth, often recommended to aspiring entrepreneurs. So one very powerful quote from that book is, "One of the most common causes of failure is the habit of quitting when one is overtaken by temporary defeat," end quote. And Howard Schultz is a great demonstration of that idea. When he was told that he wouldn't get the job at Starbucks, most people would have given up right then, but Schultz persevered. He called back, he listened to the founders concerned, and then passionately explained why he was the right person for the role, and basically framed the thing as the founder needing to stand for his own vision for the company against the other co-founders. Now, people often credit successes to luck when someone's very successful, but Howard Schultz says that many of his biggest wins and achievements in life came after this exact kind of situation. They came as a result of not giving up, even when it seemed like the door to his goal had closed, when most people would think that it's futile to keep trying. So you can read more interesting wisdom like that in our summary of Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. Now let's jump to the chapter 4 summary. First point is encountering resistance within Starbucks. So, Schultz believed right away that opening espresso bars was a game-changing idea. He'd never seen anything like it in the US. But Starbucks management felt very differently. They saw it as a distraction from their core business of selling whole coffee beans by the pound. After months and months of convincing, they finally let him open a small espresso counter in the far corner of one new store. It was an instant hit, drawing 400 to 800 customers daily, compared to the usual 250 daily customers at their other stores. But despite that success, they still didn't want to get into the restaurant business. Now, around that same time, Starbucks had the opportunity to buy Peet's Coffee, which had a few locations down in California, and that doubled their locations in the company, but it put the company in heavy debt, which left severely limited resources for trying new ideas. So Howard Schultz decided to start his own company. Frustrated by Starbucks' refusal to embrace his vision, Schultz decided to leave in 1985 and start his own company. Now, it was a very risky move, of course, especially because his wife had just become pregnant. So while he was building the company, she would have to go back to work, and they would rely more on her income. That brings us to Chapter 5. First point is about raising money and making plans. So Schultz's first big investor and supporter was Starbucks itself. The founder, Jerry Baldwin, provided $150,000 to start the venture, and that was likely to ensure Schultz would use Starbucks coffee in his new stores. So Schultz calculated that he needed $400,000 to open his first store, and then he would need another $1.2 million to expand to more locations. So from the beginning, he set his sights high to create a very big chain of stores. So he went to do a visit to Italy, and there he pitched his idea of espresso bars to a major espresso machine maker, thinking that maybe he could get all the investment money he needed right away from this Italian company. But they rejected him, and it turned out he had been too optimistic. But while he was there, Howard Schultz visited over 500 Italian espresso bars to gather ideas for his own new chain of coffee shops. And then with help from Starbucks co-founder, Gordon Bowker, who was acting as a consultant, he found the name for his new stores, which was Il Giornale, and that meant The Daily in Italian. The next point is about overcoming rejections and critics. So, in those earliest days, Schultz faced constant rejection, with 217 out of 242 investors turning him down. And worst of all, they told him all the good reasons why his idea wouldn't work, saying coffee was a shrinking industry, and they doubted anyone would pay $1.50 for a cup of it. But Schultz wasn't discouraged. Instead, he was strangely driven by their doubts because he really believed in this idea, so he just knew he would show them wrong. And he believed that he could reinvent the coffee market, much like Nike did with shoes. In the end, the early investors that he found, who put their money into the project, really believed more in him than the idea itself of espresso bars. Now, I'll connect this to another book. Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, grew it from a small discount store in the middle of America into the largest retail company in the world. How? Well, one reason is he was obsessed with studying his competitors. In his biography, which is called Sam Walton Made in America, you learn that he would spend hours in rival stores, taking notes in a yellow notepad and even asking employees lots of questions. And even on family road trips, he would need to stop at every single store along the way. Sam told his managers to do the same, to always be visiting competitors' stores and watching what they're doing, and try to find at least one new idea to test in your own store. And then that could be spread out across all the Walmart stores. Now, that kind of obsessive competitive research was also key for Starbucks' early leaders. As we mentioned, they visited over 500 espresso bars to refine their vision of what theirs should look like. So, you can read more about the Walmart story in our summary of Sam Walton, Made in America. That brings us to Chapter 6. The first point is about finding the perfect partner. Dave Olson, who ran a small Seattle cafe called Cafe Allegro, became one of Schultz's early partners and perhaps his most important. Cafe Allegro was known for its community vibe and high-quality coffee. And those were values that Olson brought to Il Journal. They were values that he ensured stayed strong. So while Dave Olson was focusing on imprinting strong company values, he did it through controlling things like coffee quality and barista training. And that perfectly complemented Schultz's more external focus on expanding the business. So he says, Dave Olson was a key part of Starbucks, with him as being managing the coffee quality and values. That left Howard Schultz free to focus on the expanding the business part of it. Next point is about buying Starbucks. So in 1987, they had successfully expanded Il Journal to 3 stores with $500,000 in annual sales. And then Schultz had the opportunity to buy Starbucks. You see, the original founders wanted to sell their 6 stores and the roasting plant they had to focus on those other stores called Pete's Coffee down in California. So they had spread themselves a bit too thin by managing both. So Schultz really wanted to buy Starbucks. He just believed in the brand and the name. He felt it had a very good feeling to it. So he was able to raise the $4 million that he needed to buy Starbucks by leveraging the early success of Il Journal. You see, because his early coffee shops had been successful, the investors now believed in him a lot more and were willing to put a lot more money in, and that allowed him to buy Starbucks. And then he really transformed Starbucks into a totally new type of company, one that sold not just coffee beans, but also cups of coffee, espresso, and lattes. It was kind of like a second rebirth. And now chapter 7. This chapter is all about coming home. When Schultz returned to Starbucks, he says it felt like coming home, with so many familiar faces he'd worked with before welcoming him back. He gave a big speech at the beginning talking about his vision for the company to inspire confidence in everyone. And every morning when he walked into the office, he would dip his hands into some of the warm, freshly roasted coffee, and that would help him stay grounded in Starbucks' core values, believing that those values would be the key to standing out from their competitors. That would be their main competitive advantage. Now, Schultz had big plans from those early days to open 150 stores in the next 5 years, and he was thrilled by the challenge of exceeding people's expectations, of doing more than anybody expected him to do. So here's another quiz question. How many customers did Schultz's espresso counter attract daily at Starbucks compared to the usual 250? Was it A, 100 to 200, B, 300 to 400, C, 400 to 800, or D, 1,000 to 1,200? Correct answer is C, 400 to 800, so about 2 to 3 times more. And that brings us to key takeaway number 3, which is building systems. By hiring experienced people and building the right processes, Starbucks could easily open a new store every day. So this begins with chapter 8 summary. First point is about fast expansion. At this point, Starbucks began growing rapidly, adding new stores every year. They added 15 in 1988, 20 the next year, then 30, then 32, and then 53 in 1992 alone. So they opened some stores in Chicago. Those were the first ones far away from Seattle. But those were slow to gain traction. And the next place they opened stores away from Seattle was in Los Angeles, and those were an immediate success. And Schultz says that there were some different factors for why LA was such a success for Starbucks. Before they opened, they were rated the number one coffee by the LA Times, and they soon became a trendy spot to go, so the popularity spread by word of mouth. And with solid processes in place, they were able to open so many new stores. It became routine, almost as easy as brewing a cup of coffee, to choose the location and then hire the contractors and hire people. They had all those processes, and that's how they're able to do it over and over and over again. The next point is about the third place. Starbucks's rapid growth, Schultz believes, was driven by its role as a third place for people, which is a comfortable spot to go besides home and work. It offered a small, affordable luxury that adds a touch of romance to everyday life. And he also says there was an unexpected rise of the popularity of specialty coffee. It happened to be a major trend across the country, which fueled Starbucks' success, which was growing at the same time. Now, I'm going to connect this to another book, which is called The E-Myth Revisited, often called a must-read for entrepreneurs. So that book teaches that to grow a business, you need to create systems and processes so your business can run without you. You see, many small business owners are experts at their craft, like a coffee shop owner who makes amazing lattes, but that book says that it's not enough to grow. The key is to step back and work on your business, not just in it. So instead of focusing on just making great lattes, that owner can create a training process for new baristas so they can teach almost anyone how to make a great latte each and every time. And this approach is what Howard Schultz and his team did at Starbucks, and that's what allowed them to open a new store every day with relative ease. As The E-Myth Revisited says, the purpose of going into business is to get free of a job so you can create jobs for other people. End quote. So you can read more about that approach in our summary of The E-Myth Revisited. Next, we have Chapter 9, Summary. So the first point here is about the healthcare coverage. Starbucks believes employees are not a cost, but crucial to their success. And that's why they began providing healthcare coverage to all employees, including part-time workers who make up two-thirds of the staff. Schultz believes this isn't just an ethical move, it also makes very good business sense. He says healthcare costs them $1,500 per person, while training a new employee costs $3,000 with all the hours of training they need to go through. So this policy helps keep Starbucks' turnover rate much lower than the industry average. They're at about 60% compared to the average of 150% or more. Also, retaining employees ensures that customers see faces of familiar baristas, which reinforces Starbucks' appeal as a third place. So the next point is about the stock option plan. Starbucks gives every worker a percentage of their annual pay in company stock, and that helps employees feel like they own a piece of the company's success. Now, in those early years, these stock options could quickly grow in value, building loyalty and motivation. After introducing this plan, Starbucks began referring to all employees as partners. Next, we have Chapter 10. First point is about building a strong foundation. So after buying Starbucks, that small Seattle chain of four stores, Starbucks raised another $4 million, and then he raised $13 million, then $15 million, before going public in 1992. So during those early years, Starbucks was actually losing hundreds of thousands of dollars each year, and they only began turning a profit in 1990. But Howard Schultz didn't see that as a bad thing. His strategy was always to invest ahead of the growth curve, which means spending heavily to prepare for future rapid expansion. The company was doubling its number of stores many years, and each store cost $350,000 to open. They also invested in a sophisticated computer system to connect older stores together, and made sure to hire experienced managers from larger companies, people who would actually save them time because they would have faced similar problems before. The next point is about learning from mentors. Schultz found his main mentor in Jeff Brotman, who was the co-founder of Costco, and he had grown his company to 100 stores in 10 years with $19 billion in revenue. And from him, Schultz learned the value of having an external mentor, especially someone who had already achieved what he aspired to do. Brotman soon joined the Starbucks board, bringing valuable experience and advice to the company. Next, we have Chapter 11. First point is about Howard Behar. So, Schultz knew that hiring smarter people than him meant giving them some control, giving up some of his own control. And that can be hard for anyone, for any entrepreneur. So, one of the biggest hires was Howard Behar, who had extensive retail experience. He shifted the company's focus more to people, not just the product. So he introduced practices like sending birthday cards to employees, offering free drinks to dissatisfied customers, and most important of all, being flexible towards customer preferences. Our next point is about Oren Smith, who was another crucial hire in those early days. Oren Smith was a Harvard MBA with experience managing much larger companies. He brought the systems and processes that Starbucks needed as it grew, balancing Schultz's entrepreneurial spirit and reassuring investors that the company would be managed responsibly. So his presence highlights the importance of having both vision and solid management in a successful company. Now, I'm going to connect this to another great entrepreneur who was named Phil Knight. He's the founder of Nike. He's actually frequently mentioned in this book. And Phil Knight wrote his own biography called Shoe Dog, which explains the story of how he built Nike into such a powerful global brand. So one key lesson that he repeats often is one he learned from the general George S. Patton. And it is this. Don't tell people how to do things, tell them what to do, and let them surprise you with their results. End quote. So Phil grew Nike by hiring people and then trusting them, giving them clear goals, and letting them figure out the best way to achieve them. In the same way, Howard Schultz started with a very clear vision for Il Giornale and later Starbucks, but as he hired very smart and competent people, he knew that he had to let go of control, because he hired them for their skills and experience. So, if you want to learn more about the story of Nike, then check out our summary of Shoe Dog by Phil Knight on Growth Summary. Now, here's another quiz question. How much does Starbucks spend on training a new employee compared to providing healthcare? Is it A, $6,000 for training, $3,000 for healthcare? B, $3,000 for training, $1,500 for healthcare. C, $6,000 for healthcare, $3,000 for training. Or D, $3,000 for healthcare, $1,500 for training. So the correct answer here is B. They spend $3,000 for training, $1,500 for healthcare. And the main point here is that it's cheaper actually to provide the healthcare benefits than it is to have a high turnover of employees. That brings us to key takeaway number 4, which is listening to customers. Starbucks learned to be flexible by adapting to customer preferences while staying true to their core values, such as by offering low-fat milk and launching Frappuccinos. So, jumping into Chapter 12, first point here is learning to be flexible. Howard Schultz had to balance Starbucks' strong core values with listening to customer preferences. A big example here is that initially he resisted offering low-fat milk for lattes and cappuccinos because it wasn't an authentic Italian option, and it simply didn't taste right to him. But after realizing how much so many customers wanted it, he agreed. And soon, half of Starbucks drinks were made with low-fat milk. And after some time, they also added flavored syrups to cater to customer tastes. But the second point here is about sticking to core values. Despite these changes, Starbucks remained committed to their most important values, like selling the highest quality coffee. To maintain control over their quality, that's why they avoided franchising, so they could make sure the coffee stays fresh and good every step of the way. However, later they opened some airport locations, and they had to do that through a licensing deal with Host Marriott. While that meant giving up some control, they were careful to make these decisions slowly and consider what their end goals were each step of the way. Next, we have chapter 13. First point is about going public. So Schultz talks about how he chose two investment banks for Starbucks's initial public offering, also known as an IPO, because he could see they valued the company's mission. And then on June 26th, 1992, Starbucks went public, and the company he had bought for $4 million a few years ago was now worth $273 million. This success rewarded early investors and employees and gave Starbucks the further leverage to raise $500 million for future growth. Next point is about the ups and downs. So becoming a public company brought some benefits, but also brought challenges like increased scrutiny and less personal privacy for Schultz. One problem is that investors often focus on comps, which stands for comparable sales growth in the same stores year over year. And he says that's not always the best measure of success. Now, in December 1995, after a record high stock price, there was an unexpected dip in Christmas sales, causing the stock to drop from $21 to $16, raising serious concerns by some people. But despite this, Schultz could see that Starbucks' actual business remained strong, with sales up 50% from the previous year. And so from these kinds of ups and downs, Schultz learned not to let the stock price dictate his emotions. He focused on running the business and providing steady leadership through the highs and lows. And now chapter 14. First point is about accelerating expansion. Between 1993 and 1995, Starbucks expanded rapidly to the East Coast, starting in cities like Washington, D.C., New York, and Boston, then moving to places like Minneapolis, Atlanta, Dallas, and Philadelphia. They followed a hub-and-spoke strategy, which means quickly opening like 20 stores in a big city where they had located a leadership team, and then expanding from there to nearby smaller cities and suburbs. They also strategically opened stores first in cities where their loyal mail-order customers were already concentrated. Next point is about Howard Schultz's personal evolution. As Starbucks grew, Schultz had to grow too. He had started out as a dreamer, knocking on investors' doors. Then he became an entrepreneur, focused on opening stores fast. But over time, he had to become a professional manager who knew how to delegate and put systems in place. And finally, he's become the leader and visionary, focusing more on the company's long-term direction and keeping their values strong. Now chapter 15. First point is about Frappuccino, a big risk that paid off. Schultz wants Starbucks to continue encouraging employees to bring new ideas, so to make the company itself entrepreneurial. A great example of that being successful is the Frappuccino. Customers, especially in California, wanted to have a blended coffee drink, which were popular in some other places in that area. And a store manager named Dina Campion started experimenting. Although Schultz was initially unsure about the idea, he felt it was too much like a fast food milkshake, he let them try it out. And the Frappuccino became a huge success right away, bringing in over $50 million that first year alone and making up 11% of sales. The next point is about selling jazz music. So this was another idea. This one came from Seattle store manager Timothy Jones, who noticed that customers were asking about the jazz music that they played in the stores. So he suggested selling CD compilations of their music. So they went for it, partnering with Blue Notes Records. They sold 75,000 copies fairly quickly, And that really showed that Starbucks could surprise customers with unique products. Now, I want to connect this to another book, which is about Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon. He says, though it makes his company different from most, how it grew so much is its customer obsession. So while most companies focus on their competitors, Amazon focuses on its customers. And that's easy for any CEO to say, but we can see it in the results and the products that Amazon has created. That customer obsession approach led to innovations like customer reviews, free 2-day shipping for Prime members, also Amazon Marketplace sellers, and more. These features, which now seem almost obvious, were groundbreaking at the time. For example, the early online shopping sites were afraid that allowing customers to openly post reviews might hurt their sales because there might be bad reviews. But Jeff Bezos believed that it was more important to help customers make an informed buying decision. And that made Amazon a go-to place for people to check customer reviews to see if a product was worth buying. Key part of their success. Now, that same customer-first approach also led Amazon to create their own marketplace years later, allowing third-party sellers to reach Amazon's own customers directly. Even though that meant competing with their own products, they believed it would be better for the customers, and the customers would get a better selection and lower prices. So you can read a lot more about the Amazon success story in our summary of The Everything Store by Brad Stone. That brings us to chapter 16. So first point is investing in research and development. In 1994, an immunologist named Don Valencia created a concentrated coffee extract that tasted just like freshly brewed coffee. Being impressed, Howard Schultz made him the head of Starbucks Research and Development, and then they invested millions of dollars in hiring scientists to create new coffee-flavored products to help the company grow beyond its stores. Next point is about canned Frappuccino and ice cream. Starbucks teamed up with Pepsi to create a canned cold coffee drinks. Their first attempt was a lightly carbonated coffee drink, which failed. However, the second idea was bottled Frappuccino, and that was an instant hit, selling out so quickly that they had to cut all marketing and invest millions in new bottling facilities because they were simply selling so many too fast. Then they also partnered with Dreyer's to make coffee-flavored ice cream, which was another big success. Throughout these moves, Schultz emphasizes the importance of maintaining the Starbucks brand's integrity by only associating it with top-quality products related to their expertise in coffee. So now we have another quiz question. After the stock price dropped in December 1995, what lesson did Schultz emphasize? Was it A, investing in research and development, B, expanding stores rapidly to recover, C, introducing new products to boost stock prices, or D, not letting the stock price affect his emotions? Correct answer here is D, not letting the stock price affect his emotions despite the ups and downs. And that brings us to key takeaway number 5, which is about handling criticism and crises. As Starbucks grew into a big company, they faced unexpected challenges to their reputation and more complex business problems like coffee bean shortages. Beginning with chapter 17, the coffee price crisis. A sudden frost in Brazil caused coffee prices to spike by over 300%. Creating a major crisis for Starbucks. So while the canned coffee companies raised their prices immediately by a lot, Starbucks decided to only increase theirs by 10%, and they found that customers were still willing to pay. The company then had to decide whether to buy more coffee at higher prices now or wait and see if prices would drop, so it was kind of a gamble. So they chose to buy more at the high prices as an insurance against any possible future price increase, because they were worrying that the prices could continue to go up or even double. But the prices eventually and pretty quickly fell back down, and Starbucks management realized they'd been strongly distorted by financial speculators. But the next point here is about becoming a mature company. During that crisis, Schultz was proud that Starbucks' core values remained strong. At no point did Starbucks even consider the obvious short-term solution of buying cheaper, lower quality coffee. Instead, to later balance their costs, they found ways to cut expenses behind the scenes by creating a more efficient and mature company and renegotiating large contracts. So in the end, that crisis forced them to become a more mature and efficient company. Now, I'll connect this to another legendary entrepreneur who you've probably heard of, Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple. Well known for his strong beliefs and charisma, which sometimes seemed to make reality distort around him. Early in his career, Steve Jobs worked at Atari, a video game company, under Nolan Bushnell, the brash and unconventional founder. Bushnell once said he taught Jobs an important lesson in leadership. Here's a quote: "Pretend to be completely in control, and people will assume that you are." End quote. And this approach likely influenced Jobs' unique management style. It also aligns with Howard Schultz's belief that leadership is about giving others confidence despite the ups and downs in the company's numbers, and even when you might feel unsure yourself on the inside. But you can learn more about Steve Jobs' approach to business and branding in our summary of Steve Jobs by Walter Isaacson. Next, we have Chapter 18. This one is all about building a brand with authenticity. Starbucks grew so fast with minimal advertising, spending less than $10 million in its first 10 years. Instead, Schultz says they built their brand using authenticity, where customers feel like they share values with the company. That's the company they will want to do business with. It's similar to how Nike doesn't really talk that much about their shoes, technical features. Instead, they champion athletic performance. So Starbucks focused on three essentials to build their brand. First was strict coffee quality standards. Second was training employees to connect with customers. And third was creating a comfortable and inviting store experience. That brings us to Chapter 19. This one is about partnerships, balancing risk and reward. So in this chapter, Schultz talks about how Starbucks took a risk by partnering with United Airlines, which flies 20 million passengers a year. Now, this kind of a partnership would potentially double how many people would drink Starbucks coffee each year, so he believed it could introduce a lot of people to Starbucks coffee. But Starbucks needed to protect their reputation, because airline coffee is famously bad. So they required that United Airlines install special coffee machines and to train their staff in a special way. In the beginning, it didn't work out completely, and it took a few months to perfect, but they eventually made it work, and most people seem to rate Starbucks coffee much better than the coffee you would usually get at airlines. But despite this success story, Starbucks is very selective with the partnerships, and they turn down way more than they accept, and that's to maintain their reputation and quality. And that brings us to Chapter 20. First point is about the challenges of getting big. So as Starbucks grew, one of the big challenges was to avoid being seen in a negative way as a big impersonal corporation. People often worry that big businesses make their neighborhoods lose their unique character and overwhelm small local businesses. But Howard Schultz argues that it's unfair to compare Starbucks to something like Walmart, because Starbucks doesn't bring people out of the towns, but it brings people into existing downtown and retail areas, And they also don't undercut the prices of local shops. Instead, they're usually more expensive. The next point in this chapter is the solution, which he believes to be human connection. So as Starbucks grows bigger and bigger, Schultz believes the key is for them to stay connected with customers as on a personal level, that human connection. So he now believes the most important part of the company is not marketing, but human resources, which is hiring and keeping the right people. These employees create the personal touch that can make Starbucks feel local, no matter how big it gets as a company as a whole. And he believes some ways to do this, to attract the right people, is by offering stock options, those health benefits we talked about. Also, this chapter talks about being committed to diversity and also promoting people from within. These are all ways Starbucks keeps this connection strong. Next, we have chapter 21. First point is about Starbucks being under fire. As Starbucks grew into this large national chain, it started facing more criticism. One big one is that some people were accusing Starbucks of exploiting workers in countries like Guatemala, where coffee farmers earned very little, while Starbucks sold the coffee for much more. Now, Schultz says the situation is complicated because they buy coffee from sources that mix beans from thousands of farms, and that makes it difficult to track which specific farm their beans come from, which makes it more difficult for them to ensure working standards like a clothing manufacturer can check the conditions in specific factories. But as a result of that activism, Starbucks created a framework which aimed to help improve living conditions for farmers in countries where they bought coffee. However, Schultz admits that it's tough for any company to be perfectly socially responsible. The next point is about the environmental contradiction. Starbucks also faced criticism for its use of disposable cups, especially in an environmentally conscious city like Seattle. But Schultz says that if they didn't offer takeaway cups, then they would simply have very few customers. Now, the company used to serve many of their hot drinks in double cups, but that increased waste. So to reduce it, they introduced a paper sleeve and also began working on more eco-friendly cup options. Next, we have chapter 22. This one is all about creating a distinctive store design. Another bit of criticism they faced was for having stores that all looked the same, cookie cutter. And that is unlike local coffee shops that tend to reflect the unique character of their neighborhoods. To address this, Starbucks created a new store design that they wanted to feel special and not like a typical chain. So there was a whole big team to do this in Starbucks, which began with studying the history and mythology of coffee to develop design elements that felt warm and handmade. Schultz emphasized that everything matters in store design because a big part of why people come to Starbucks is for that experience of having a comfortable luxury. Yet at the same time, their costs of opening a store were getting larger and larger. So another goal of this redesign was to bring costs down. And they were able to do that by mass ordering certain elements that all stores share, like the wooden counter. Now, I'm going to connect this to another top business leader who's named Robert Iger, who was CEO of Disney for 15 years. And he recently came back as the CEO. Now, early in his career at ABC Sports, Robert Iger's mentor was Rune Arledge, and he taught them this lesson. Here's a quote: "Innovate or die, and there's no innovation if you operate out of fear of the new or untested," end quote. So Robert Iger applied this lesson to major projects, like launching Disney Plus, acquiring Marvel and Pixar, and expanding Disney globally. In a similar way, Schultz was always exploring new ideas, like the partnership with Pepsi and United Airlines, and introducing products like low-fat milk lattes and frappuccinos. So you can also read our summary of Ride of a Lifetime by Robert Iger, which tells the story of how he was able to become the CEO of one of the biggest companies in the world. He started as a news anchor. Now, let's move on to chapter 23 of this book. The first point is learning to rely on long-range planning. So in 1995, Starbucks had a very tough Christmas season with lower sales growth than usual. They had made some mistakes, like not using traditional Christmas colors on their packaging. Now, Schultz tried to correct that situation on the fly by relying on his instincts, as they had in the past. But it didn't work, and he realized that as Starbucks had grown, they couldn't rely on these quick fixes anymore. Instead, they needed to rely more on the long-term planning to keep the company on track. He realized that Starbucks had become much more like steering a big ship that takes time to change directions, rather than a small speedboat. Next point here is the danger of compartmentalization. Starbucks learned the hard way that what might be good for one department's numbers can harm the brand and company as a whole. For example, during that Christmas season, they switched from real eggnog to a cheaper flavored syrup, and it was to save money. Now, that change led to customer complaints and a quick drop in sales. So the next year, they learned from that and went back to using real eggnog, understanding that maintaining quality is crucial for the brand. And finishing up with chapter 24, there's one main point here, is that winning together is what matters most. Schultz concludes that the most important thing for him is winning together as a team, not just focusing on profits or sales numbers. He says it's the passion and energy of a dedicated group of people that truly makes a difference. And while he acknowledges that tough times will be ahead and the company can't realistically keep growing at 50% every year, Schultz feels hopeful and optimistic about facing those challenges with his team. So here's a final quiz question. What does Schultz believe is the most important part of Starbucks as the company grows? Is it A, marketing, B, human resources, C, pricing strategy, or D, store design? So the correct answer here is B, human resources. Okay, that's all for this summary, and I'll see you in the next one.